How to determine the right career for yourself? That is a question we're going to address today, among many others, in this interview with a former Ivy League Career Services Director with over 30 years of experience in the field. Hello and welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that wonderful moment where you can jump up and down and say, yes, I'm in. And first, a quick reminder, if you have an admissions-related question that you would like me to address, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/131. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. Oh, and FYI, if you just want to ask your question in a comment on the blog, feel free to do that too. We're developing a wonderful and thoughtful community on Accepted, so feel free to comment there, share, whatever. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Karen Ash, former director of the Career Management Center at Cornell's Johnson School, a career coach at Cornell's College of Engineering, and at one point, the director of Cornell's Career Services for Cornell University's undergrads. Karen recently joined Accepted as a career and admissions consultant, but right now we're going to tap into her decades of experience in career services and higher ed at Cornell University. Oh, and I forgot to mention that she has a PhD in educational psychology, also from Cornell University. Karen, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Pleased to have you here. Now, how did you get into career services and admissions? Did you, when you were 5 years old, say, I want to go into career services, or was it a later epiphany?
You know, you're not that far off.
Are you serious? I thought I was being a wise guy.
When I think back on my career, I realize I was pretty enthused about the guidance office in junior high school, and I used to go hang out there. I liked the woman who ran it, and I used to help her. I volunteered to put books away and keep the books straightened in an alphabetical order, and I just really found it interesting without any intention at that point. And it wasn't until I went to college and ended up majoring in psychology and then directly referred from our career services office at the University of Connecticut to go to a graduate school where I would have the opportunity to do an internship in the first year in an office of my choosing, and I chose the career services office. And I think part of that was because I had been referred there by one and thought, you know, it just sounded really interesting to me rather than going into clinical psychology. So that was what started me off. And my first job after graduate school was at the University of South Florida in Tampa. And although my main job was running the residence hall, again, I was able to put 25% of my time into an office, and I chose the career office and then took off from there.
So you were one of those lucky people who really seemed to have had a pretty clear path and at a very young age.
Yes, I was lucky because I do see how some people struggle, and especially people who have really broad interests, like a lot of liberal arts students.
Yeah.
In so many areas, and so it's hard for them to then focus on just one.
I know when I was, I'm obviously a lot of, except it started as a personal statement editing service, so it's obviously expanded quite a bit since then, over the last 20 years. But it's ironic, I still love reading biographies, and as a child, I read every biography I could in my school library. Uh-huh. Even if I wasn't terribly interested in the topic or knew much about the person. Like, I have no interest in football. I was reading about, you know, Johnny Unitas or something in elementary school. And my teachers and parents, especially my mother, were just begging me to go read something else. Uh-huh. And if I wanted variety, I'd go for historical fiction. But, you know, I still love history. I still love biography. And of course, I ended up in work. It wasn't so much career guidance, but it's very much about learning the life stories of my clients, and that's indeed what
absolutely.
I like. The, you know,
absolutely, about. Yeah, the similarity
right.
between missions and career services.
Right. Now but I definitely didn't know it at age 5. You recently joined Accepted as a consultant, And in your accepted bio, you wrote that your PhD dissertation focused on what factors were significant reasons for students to stay or leave the first job taken after graduate school. And I'm going to ask you, what are the most common reasons that graduates stay or leave their first job after grad school?
Well, like with most PhD studies, it's always, you know, it's hard to generalize to everyone from a subset of data. But I've studied 10 years of graduate students from the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell. And I actually had worked at the school for a little over 10 years. So I knew all of these graduates. So I got a very high response rate. And I was really, one of my hypotheses, I was trying to compare rotational training programs to direct hire positions and whether that influenced whether people were retained or not in their first job after school. And one of the reasons I was very interested in this topic was because I would watch these students struggle with the decision of where to go, which company. They were fortunate at that school to have many choices because it's a top-rated school for human resources. So they would struggle and struggle with which company to go with, and then I'd see them move beyond that job, and I'd wonder why. So my study, the only significant reason statistically was for what you would call adult development growth. It was geographical needs, either to move closer to family because they were far away or to move away from family and explore a new area. That was one reason.
Right.
And another reason was dual career issues because they were getting to the age where they were finding their partners and one or the other would have a career decision to make and they'd have to move. So those were the only reasons. You know, all those other things that companies try very hard to do to please their new employees, like mentoring programs and career development paths, those were important, but they weren't the statistically significant reasons why they left.
That's fascinating. So actually the job conditions and the career and all that was rarely the reason that they would leave.
Right. But then, you know, it's the age group because they're right. In their late 20s, early 30s, and it's when they're really exploring the world before they settle down. And so it makes sense that those were the reasons.
Right. Right. Now, speaking about 20-somethings, I frequently speak to 20-somethings who I think have been on this treadmill all their lives. You know, that you got to go to a certain preschool to go to a private elementary and middle school to get into an elite high school, to get accepted to an Ivy League college, to get a job at Goldman or McKinsey, or now it's probably Google or Facebook. And there's nothing wrong with going to great schools at any point in one's life. And there's a lot to be said for working at wonderful companies. But I sometimes am concerned that this, what I like to call treadmill approach to life, doesn't leave one with a lot of room to reflect, to find purpose or passion or meaning, or simply figure out what you would enjoy. How would you advise a young person who might feel caught on this treadmill to explore effectively, to get off of it, and really find something that they would enjoy doing for the rest of their lives?
It's a really good question. And certainly in my 37 years of working with students, It came up again and again with the alumni who would come back and talk to me. And I would have to say that one group where it was more apt to happen than perhaps others, well, besides the Wall Street careers, which you know going into it, a lot of people are going into it for a few years to gain experience and then move on. But attorneys, a lot of people would become attorneys and then realize that litigation was just not something they wanted to do.
Even transactional law.
Yeah, that, you know, it was just the stress level was phenomenal and feeling pulled by so many different factions and wanting to do something different. So, you know, it's not easy when you're working full time to find the time, but there is always time. You have to make time. And I think, you know, the first thing you can do is start reading both books about areas that interest you, careers that interest you, but also self-help books about self-reflection. There are so many career books that you can get in any bookstore or in a library or even online that help you go through the process of really evaluating what are your main interests, because values are important, skill set is important, but most of us have some real strong interest or passion that may be hidden for a while, but it ends up bubbling to the top. And explore that, talk to people then in that field that is even close to that field, and begin interviewing them for information. Find out how did they get started in their career and what advice would they have for this person who's working full time to be able to begin preparing to make this move. What could they do in the few hours of spare time that they had, perhaps volunteering or shadowing somebody at their work? But just to learn from talking to other people, what are some fields you could begin to get to explore, even subsets of fields? Maybe you can't get to your ideal right away, but you can get to a stepping stone. So it's self-reflection and then research. Research the field.
Do you have? You mentioned that there are so many very good books out on either career guidance or guidance, I guess, guided self-reflection, maybe structured self-reflection. Is there anyone in particular that you would recommend?
Well, you know, for business, one of the things we used in our office was Your Career in Business by Timothy Butler and James Waldrop. Takes you through a very active process of self-reflection and then marketing, figuring out where you fit, where you should market yourself, and how to market yourself. A general book that has been out on the market since the 70s and is updated all the time and is still quite a good book is What Color Is Your Parachute? Because it forces you.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's what you were going to say.
Yeah, there's lots of competing books, but I think that one, it gets to the point. And he was one of, Richard Bowles was one of the first authors to really talk about getting out of this just applying to jobs that are listed somewhere and instead focus on what is it you want to do and go after it. And I have seen time and time again, students who do that and do the process thoroughly, they do get what they want. It may not be the first job they get, but they eventually get there.
Right, right. Okay. Now, so basically, you're talking about online research, book research, library research, and also informational interviews, talking to people.
Right. That's the thing is extremely important because with every person you talk to, the last question you ask should be, who else should I talk to? So you never run out of people to meet and learn from. And with every person you talk to, you're going to learn something about the field and perhaps uncover a job you didn't even know existed. You didn't even know there was such a thing.
Right.
And you prepare yourself for it.
Right.
And Richard Bowles say, find where there's a challenge in an organization, and then you fill it. You offer right. to meet that challenge and create the job.
Right. What about a different scenario that I think some young people, young professionals struggle with, or young adults struggle with? What about the person who knows what they're passionate about, but it doesn't pay? What if you're interested in, Milton, and there aren't a lot of jobs for Milton experts, or you're interested in some tribe in a remote place on the earth, and there aren't a lot of jobs for people who are experts in this tribe. So you know what your passion is, you know what you'd love to do, but the marketplace isn't too enthusiastic about that passion.
Right. there are lots of jobs that would get you close to that passion. So let's say it's the tribe that you're interested in.
Right.
Go to that area of the world and start exploring and start figuring out what kinds of research maybe is done about this tribe. Are there things to be written about the tribe that haven't been written? Are there photographs to be taken? You know,
travel business.
I'm a true optimist when it comes to career development. I don't think there's many dead ends. I really don't. I mean, you can be a pessimist and get to a dead end, but it's a big world out there. And if you do your homework and you're really enthusiastic about what it is you're interested in, there are a lot of doors that open, and you make them open.
Right.
My nephew was a animator, graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design. And when he got out, he became a cartoonist, and he created cartoons for Saturday Night Live and for the Cartoon Network. But it was all contract work, no benefits, and not much of a salary.
Right.
And realized he wasn't going to be able to support a family that way. And so he decided to give it up and get a job in education, maybe teach art. And he got a degree in education, and he lives in the Boston area and could not get a teaching job.
Goodness, wow.
Now, a year later, he is working for Rhode Island School of Design and University Massachusetts Institute of Art, and he's teaching animation to college students, and he's making a living. So he's come back to his love of animation, and he's doing it on a level he never thought he'd do it on, teaching students. And, I just see that happen again and again with students who don't give up. If you really love something and you really want to make it happen, you can make it happen.
Just try a different angle or a different approach to engage with what you love. Okay.
The more research you do and the more people you talk to, the more you'll uncover that.
All right. Now, you were in career services at Cornell on the undergrad level. You were also working at one different point in your career, working primarily with MBAs. And you also worked somewhat with Cornell's engineering school. What were some of the distinct challenges that graduates of these very different programs faced?
Well, you know, undergrads, many of them are still being supported by their parents. I think the challenge with them is getting them to really focus on getting a job. I think because not really had the pressure of supporting themselves,
yeah,
there's that immediacy that you see the need with MBAs. So getting them to focus. The other, you know, issue with undergrads is, especially if they're in liberal arts, they love history. Well, what are they going to do with history? So getting them to do a lot of exploration about careers so that they can perhaps not use history as their, you know, they were not going to be a historian, but maybe they'll end up in some field of law that, you know, relies on the ability to do historical research. So getting them to focus, that's the challenge, getting them to explore. With MBAs, I think the challenge is really they arrive and 3 weeks later they're interviewing for an internship.
Right, right.
That internship is so key to what they might end up doing a year and a half later. And so the challenge in a career office is how do you get them ready in really a month? And so that the immediacy with them is the challenge. And with engineering, at least my experience with engineers is they were brilliant at Cornell, you know, the top 10 engineering school. They were really brilliant. But they didn't believe it, and they'd have 3.7 GPA and say to me, my GPA is not good enough, or, you know, I don't really have anything to offer an employer. You know, they just didn't believe that they were the marketable. And so just building confidence, getting them to understand how really good they were, and teaching them about networking and the importance of asserting themselves and getting out into the community and meeting people was a real challenge, because so many of the students I worked with were international students, and they were from China and India, where networking is not really a concept they're familiar with.
Yeah, they don't have it.
What was the challenge with them?
I mean, I think they actually, I think the networks are extraordinarily important in those cultures, but the idea of making it an activity is, I think, an American concept.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yep.
That's very interesting. Now, you mentioned that for MBAs, recruiting starts within weeks of them arriving on campus. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons I've said this many times, that knowing your goal before you arrive on the business school campus is so important. I'll never forget the time that I was giving a presentation at a consulting firm, and I was talking for about an hour on the importance of an MBA goal and what an MBA goal, post-MBA goal should be, and how to present it, and blah, blah, blah. And one guy, after I was done, so maybe it wasn't the full hour, maybe it was 45 minutes in or 35 minutes in, because I probably allowed time for question and answer, he says to me, "Do you mean to say that if I don't know what I want to do after my MBA, I shouldn't apply?" And I said, thought for a minute, I said, "Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying." And the guy couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. But can you give us some insight into the role of employability and the post-MBA goal in the admissions part of the process?
You know, I was fortunate where I worked. The admissions office was quite enlightened, and in terms of their understanding that career services had a key role to play in helping them make decisions about applicants. So we took turns on the admissions committee, sitting in on the decision-making sessions where, you know, the interview, if there was an interview, had been done and all the paperwork was looked at, and now it came down to, okay, are we going to let this person in or not? And what are we looking at? What are the factors? And so the career services role was really to, you know, I used to say to students when they were applying, even if you aren't absolutely sure, sound like you're absolutely sure, because it's really important to come across like you know what you want to do and you're going to go after it, and it makes sense with what you did before, and you know, that there's a story to it. You can change your mind. People did go on internships and decide this was really not for them, and you do have time to change your mind. But it makes it harder. It makes it much harder. So if you are able to do your homework before you go to business school, you're going to have a much easier time. My role when I was on the committee was looking at, does the story make sense? Does the person come across as genuine? Is this really what they want to do? And looking at it from an employer's perspective, is this person marketable? Are they persuasive? Are they going to be the right fit for the organization? And so I think we added value. I mean, the admissions folks were excellent, but I think we had up-to-date information. We talked to employers every day. They did not. And we're able to translate what the employers really were looking for in MBA candidates. You know, not just what is it they want to do, but their leadership abilities. Have they shown leadership? You mm-hmm. can't just show leadership in business school. It has to be something that you've shown all along. Do they come across as very confident? Do they seem to have good communication skills? It's critical for most MBA positions, because employers are coming to hire MBAs to be the leaders of their organization. They're not coming for the back office operations. That's what they use undergrads for. So this is the future leadership of most organizations, and those are the qualities they're seeking.
Right, and that's what they're willing to pay the big dollars for. They're not paying for spreadsheets.
Right. Oh, they know what your business school courses consist of. They know you're going to learn to be very analytical. They know you're going to learn to use data and synthesize a lot of information. They expect that. But what they want to see in the interviewing process is, can you communicate? Can you persuade me? Can you make decisions? Can you lead? Can you influence the people around you and on your team? And if you're a consultant, can you influence and persuade the clients?
What advice would you give somebody who's trying to use the MBA to switch careers? I actually just had this an email from somebody with that question. So he was coming from a background, I think, in financial services, and he loves gaming, and he wants to go into tech product development. So, you know, like, how would you, that's a fairly major career switch. How would that person, in your view, portray his experience in such a way that would appeal to business school and ultimately appeal to an employer? He has to appeal to both.
You know, an awful lot of folks, when they go to business school, do end up changing direction to a degree. And sometimes it happens because of classes they take. I'm thinking of a student I had who was came from healthcare consulting, and she ended up in her first finance class and absolutely loved it. And the teacher saw something in her and really felt she was a prime person for investment banking. And that was the farthest thing from her mind when she came to school, and she ended up going into investment banking, and she's still in it. I saw her recently this summer. She was back visiting the school, and she's thriving. She's doing really, really well. So, you know, I think the quizzes you take make a big difference, and if your professors see a talent, many of the professors at the top business schools, they have a lot of contact with employers, and employers look to them for references and recommendations. They'll ask career offices for that, and we won't give it to them because our role is to be totally neutral and be fair to all students. So we can't put one student in front of another. Professors will.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, so I think doing well in courses and then joining clubs that allow you to get exposure to the field, getting experiences. You know, some of the schools offer externships where you get to spend a week between breaks with an alum who's in the field, and then gaining an internship because of that externship that you had. And even if the school doesn't formally have an externship, create one. Call some alumni and ask if you can hang out with them for a week. You know, you'll be their shadow to learn more about what they're doing. And you'd be surprised how many alumni of these top schools get very enthusiastic about helping current MBAs, especially if they come across as passionate about the field.
Right, right. Okay, now one of the most, I think, sought-after positions among our clients, and it's not just our clients. If you look at GMAC data, career services data for the top schools, is of course management consulting. Now, let's say I don't think you disagree with me on that. Am I right?
Right.
Okay, we're on the same page there. Now, if someone wants to go into management consulting after business school, let's say they were in software before, they were, you know, software development or I don't know, financial analysis or something like that before business school, and they want to go into management consulting after business school, and they want to use the MBA as a vehicle to change career directions, how can they prepare themselves or position themselves for a career in this really, really hot field? You know, I'm talking particularly about the strategy consulting and the elite, you know, McKinsey, right. Bain, Boston Consulting, et cetera.
They really don't care what your undergraduate major was. They're looking for a skill set. They're looking for someone who, you know, has high GPA, high GMAT score, and they're looking for someone who is really analytical and has good communication skills. because so much of what you have to do in consulting is sell your ideas. But in order to do that, you also have to understand the problem and be able to do a lot of research and data analysis to be able to present your argument. So for consulting, it's acing that case interview that becomes really key. And if you've got high scores, you know, and a high GPA, and you ace your case interviews, it has no, your major beforehand and what you did beforehand has no bearing. But, you know, there's a little bit of a bias towards frontline experience. Consulting firms like people who were in sales. They love athletes. You know, it's all about competition, being driven, being absolutely devoted to the work.
Right. Also confident.
The hours, and athletes are proven candidates for that. So are salespeople, especially if they were successful salespeople. So, you know, there's a little bit of bias in that way, but really, in the end, I've seen every kind of major go into consulting.
Right, right. We once had on Victor Chang, who wrote Case Interview Secrets, about, you know, with tips on how to prepare for the case interview. I don't know if you're familiar with that book. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how the, I don't know if the key thing, but one of the key elements that these elite consulting firms are looking for is the ability to walk into an executive's office. And the executive is typically far more experienced and probably, you know, maybe a decade or two older, and convince him of a particular course or recommendation or whatever. Now, obviously, data, use of data is critical, but also just presence, poise, and that, as you said, communication skills.
That executive could have been a her, too.
Of course,
him.
Absolutely. Correction accepted, absolutely.
Right. It's presence, it's confidence, and it's persuasion. And, you know, that's what they're going to look for in addition to being able to solve the problems in a case interview is how right. are you coming across? If you're coming across like a nervous wreck, it's not going to look very well.
Right. Now, let's go back to some of the nuts and bolts work that I'm sure you were doing, at least at some point in your career, and that would be, you know, resumes and cover letters and things like that. What are some of your top tips for resumes?
Resumes, you know, it's pretty simple. Actually, it is one of the probably least likable things you ever want to do in your life is write a resume. But there's a simple formula to it. It you know, keep it to one page. Have it be focused so that if you know where you're going, if you know what your goal is, everything in your resume should support that goal. And use action verbs. So you're not using a lot of extra verbiage. You start each sentence, and it doesn't even have to be a full sentence. It's a bullet point. And you start it with the action verbs such as organized, managed, synthesized, created, designed, analyzed, and then finish that thought. You include extracurricular activity, achievements, or leadership roles, but not as filler, only if they were really, really important to you. You don't put anything in a resume unless you really felt this was a true enthusiastic experience for you.
Makes sense to me.
You don't need to have references listed. If they want references, they'll ask. So you can keep it to one page, and you don't need to list every single honor you ever had in your life either. You can list a few key ones, but, you know, by the time we're talking about MBAs, employers are less interested in honors, and they're more interested in your results, your achievements. And so every line in your resume, if you can, should show a result. So not just an activity, but what happened? What value did you add as a result of doing this activity? How did you add value to the organization?
I always tell people, don't focus on responsibilities, focus on achievements, contributions. What about for cover letters? Do you have some? That was fantastic. But
more excruciating. Although, if you really look, if you are truly enthusiastic about the job and the company, it becomes much easier to write because it's genuine and it's coming from your heart. But a cover letter, you simply introduce, why are you writing this letter? Why is this person receiving this letter? You're writing to them for what position, what specific position, in what company? And then the next paragraph or two are, what makes you the right person for this job? So here is where you highlight the things from your resume that really relate to this specific job. And then you close with an action, if you can, such as, I will follow up this letter with a phone call. In the letter, if you can say you spoke to this person or that person at an organization to show you've done your homework and you learned more about the culture. I read a cover letter recently from a former student who was a great success. And her cover letter, she had written probably 6 or 7 names of people she had talked to at the organization. That was part of her cover letter because it showed that she really wanted to work for this company.
Yeah, wow. That's a lot of people.
And that's all it is. It's really just showing how your background relates to where you want to go. And if your background doesn't relate that well, then what other things have you done to show your interest in this field, in this company?
Let's move forward in the hiring process a little bit. What about interview preparation? For the more typical, we'll get to case interviews in a minute, but what are your favorite tips for interview preparation?
Practice, practice, practice. We used to bring a consulting firm to campus. We paid a lot of money to have them put every single student through 2 practice interviews. And in this, they actually worked with coaches, executive coaches. And they were put through behavioral interviews, and then it was taped. And they were given feedback, and they were handed the tape so they could watch how they did, and then they could hear the feedback. And they would have 2 of these. One of the things these consultants had them do was what they called the J technique: talk about a weakness, but turn that weakness into a positive. How this may be something I need more development in, and this is what I'm doing about it. So. I think it's, again, the homework of self-reflection before any interview with a company. What is it they're looking for? Find that out first and then highlight everything in your background that relates specifically to it. And do it in a poised, confident, articulate manner, and that takes practice.
And what about case interviews that specifically use the consulting companies? Do you have any special tips for them?
Right. There are so many books out there on case interviews. You can buy one from Harvard's, I think it's from their career services office, that has a lot of cases listed and how you go through the case. It helps you analyze each of the cases presented. And so reading those cases is important, but I think if you can get practice, if you can get a consultant to spend a half a day with you and put you through a case interview, that's the best practice you can get. And again, use alumni.
Right, right. And friends, what do you wish I would have asked you?
Maybe why I did this for 37 years.
Okay. Why have you done this for 37 years?
I absolutely loved what I did and still do, as you can see, because I'm still consulting.
Right.
I think working with young people trying to figure out what it is they want to do with their lives and helping them get there is really exciting. And limitless possibilities out there, and you just have to have the right attitude and the right preparation, and you can make it happen. And it's really exciting to watch people land the types of positions they set out to get. And then to hear from them later what they liked or didn't like about it, and that's okay too. People
sure.
often think you're going to find the magic career right off the bat. And for many, it's a very zigzag approach to eventually ending up in the position that satisfies most of your needs, because you're changing too throughout life.
Sure.
As you're exposed to things. So it makes sense that you would need to move on. So, you know, I think that's exciting. It's not, it's something to look forward to. It's like a treasure hunt.
Right. And of course, no job is always, no career, no job, no anything is going to be 100% roses and wonderful every moment of the day and every day. But
no, not at all. And at certain points in your life, you know, the job may satisfy you, and then you get used to it. You are able to accomplish what you set out to accomplish, and then boredom sets in. So it's time to move on.
Right. Any last words of advice?
Stay positive.
Okay. Well, that sounds like great advice. Karen, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm going to include links to the books, a couple of books that Karen suggested earlier, What Color Is Your Parachute, and Discover Your Career in Business. I'll include those in the show notes at info.exhibit.com/131. And I'm also going to include a link to Karen's bio so that anybody who would like to contact her for more advice, either on career planning, career advice, or MBA admissions, you can get a hold of her there. And listener, I want to thank you too for joining Karen Ash and me for this, our 131st episode. If you find the show worthwhile, I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe. That way you won't miss any of our future shows, which will include an interview with MIT Sloan's MBA Admissions Director and UCLA Anderson's Admissions Director. Additionally, you can go back and easily listen to past interviews with MBA leaders and directors like Donna Clark of Tuck and Amanda Carlson of Columbia, or the product manager of the Harbus, HBS's student-run newspaper, or recent alumni and leaders in graduate admissions and definitely the career services world. And if you have a question for me, please ask it at info.exhibit.com/131. or by sending an email to questions@exhibit.com. Thanks again for coming and spending this half hour or hour, whatever we're at. It seemed like a half an hour, but I think it's a little bit more. This is Admissions Straight Talk, produced by Exhibit, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.